You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Somebody in the control room messed with the wrong valves, and instead of surfacing bow first, we come out arse end first, and the prop got chewed up. But we only missed the bottom of the lock, allegedly, by 25 foot. So we was quite close to getting killed.
This is Cold War Conversations.
Thanks to Patreon supporter Jim Black for providing our intro today. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. John Andrews joined the Royal Navy in 1981 and went on to serve aboard HMS Repulse, one of the UK's Polaris nuclear missile submarines from 1982. His role was Missile Compartment Patrol, which included the security of the nuclear missile compartment as well as assisting in the maintenance of the missile tubes and the nuclear missiles themselves. John shares details of life aboard the ship, including missile launch tests, the use of alcohol, practical jokes, and escape procedures from a submerged submarine, and many more. Now, this podcast relies on listener support to enable me to continue to capture these incredible stories and make them available to you for free. I'd really appreciate it if you could support my work and help to preserve Cold War history via one-off or monthly donations. If you'd like to learn more, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. You can also join our Facebook discussion group where the Cold War conversation continues between episodes. Just search for Cold War Conversations on Facebook. Now, this episode was recorded at the Hack Green Nuclear Bunker Soviet Threat Event, so you will hear some background noise. But I'm delighted to welcome John Andrews to our Cold War conversation.
I served from Royal Navy from 15th of June 1981 till the 9th of January officially, 1985, and then was discharged a month later. Joined HMS Repulse port crew in September 1982, and then obviously I went on a couple of patrols and work-up periods, and then I'd done a short stint working in SESD, which was the Submarine Environmental Support Department, and then I was discharged shortly after that.
Why did you join the Royal Navy?
Originally, quite ironically, probably the romantic version of join the Navy, see the world, you know, and see the sea, which I've seen no sea and no world, except the inside of a submarine.
And what was the initial induction like? What was your training?
Basic training. I quite enjoyed basic training because obviously there's different challenges. Met people from different backgrounds, so that was quite interesting. And I've come from sort of a working class background, and I've previously been an electrician, apprentice electrician for 18 months. I got made redundant, so I'd always wanted to join the Navy, and I thought, this is the time to do it. So I popped off to the careers office and signed up for myself for 9 years, and then went and told my parents that I would be joining the Navy in a few months' time on the 15th of June. So yeah, the basic training was 6 weeks long, if I remember rightly, at HMS Rally. It's just a mixture of PT, square bashing, basically character building stuff, which I've sort of seen as a game really, but some of the younger kids, like the 16-year-olds, really suffered.
What do you mean by character building? Can you give me a bit more detail on that?
Yeah, there was like a lot of kit inspections and a lot of bollockings and a lot of like kit thrown around and like kit thrown out the window and catch your kit before it gets to the floor, that sort of stuff, which for me I always found quite funny because I'm one of these people who find so-called serious situations quite humorous.
And what was your first time at sea? I mean, did you have good sea legs or?
Yeah. No problem at all, really. The first time I went to sea with the other crew, which was the starboard crew, and I went on as a roider, which is like a spare body on the exercise period. And I think we was at sea for about 2 weeks on exercise, which I spent sleeping on a camp bed in between the missile tubes in my own department, which is the missile compartment. So a lot of lights, a lot of noise, so I didn't get much sleep, but that's the way it goes.
And how did you find being confined?
At the time, I never had an issue with it, none at all, but obviously later on in life, it's come to bite me on the rear. So now I've actually been diagnosed with PTSD-based claustrophobia, and sort of I was having anxiety attacks, but I'm on medication now, so that's all under control. So I'm okay now, really.
That's good to hear. What were you being trained to do? What was going to be your role on the submarine?
Well, I initially joined the Navy as a weapons engineer and mechanic, brackets O, which stands for ordnance. So it was heavy electrics and hydraulics, etc., and some electronics. But mainly, that would have on a ship, that would involve missile systems, weapons systems, and things akin to that, or even the armoury type stuff as well, depending on where you got slotted on the ship. But obviously when I got drafted to submarines, I then got drafted to a different submarine category than I expected to. And then I got told what job I was doing rather than had a choice in what job. And my actual title was MC Patrol, which is Missile Compartment Patrol. Basically, as a junior rate, my job was just to do patrols around checking valve lineups, security was probably one of the upper things, fire watch, and then helping the senior rates with all the maintenance on the missile systems and the missile tubes themselves and the missiles.
I understand that with the security, did you have a club or something to?
There was a nightstick. There was a roped-off area around the control panel in the missile compartment and a nightstick, but the nightstick was always left inside the roped-off area, and that was only there to get people away from the sensitive material. The rest of the time, all I had was a torch. I'd be walking around with myself in a torch, basically.
And did you have to be vetted to take this role? Did they check your background?
I would have thought so, but there was no sort of direct vetting that I was aware of. Nobody ever said anything to me about or asked me any weird questions about my background or anything, no.
So with the maintenance, what were you having to do? Were you having to crawl into small spaces?
There was one job that was very tight space, which was when we used to have to do the silicon in the bottom of the missile tubes, which basically helped with the pressure to launch the missiles at that stage. And from what I can remember, the crawl space was probably less than a meter high and very tight under the missile tube. And you had to sort of two of us wiggling there, me and a senior eight. And we used to have to pump the silicon in. And from memory, I'm sure it was over 2,000 PSI. And the senior eight made it quite obvious that if the O was detached, that we'd get sliced up. So obviously that was a bit of a worry. Whether that was him playing a trick on me, I don't know. But, you know, it's one of them things.
It would certainly focus your concentration.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I'm sure.
Most definitely.
And can you remember when you first went through a missile launch test?
Yeah, I still do my Part 3 training, so I wasn't actually qualified as a submariner because you have to do what they call Part 3 training, where you get a large book and you have to work through different sections of the submarine. So, yeah, I think I was asleep in bed, recovering from whatever duties I'd been doing, and had hardly any sleep. And then there was an alert for a WSRT, which was the missile warning. So I had to get out of bed as quick as I could, run to my department, get on a headset, and then I had a small manual that you used to have to go through. We'd done a sound check, a comms check, and then there was various parts where I had to align valves and say that it was ready, etc., and just go through that process. And everybody had a different role in the missile compartment to perform.
And did you know it was a test?
Yes, I did, yeah, because of the announcement, but we still treated it like a live fire. I mean, up to the point where it was actually the empty tube was fired, then it was treated like the real thing.
Right, so as I understand it with Polaris, it sort of went to a hover just below the surface.
Yeah.
And So that was part of the test. So yeah. Somebody else was doing the hover in the control room.
Yeah.
And then you were preparing the empty tube. So yes. Not every tube was filled with missiles.
No, but the most people on board wouldn't necessarily have that knowledge. Obviously, in the missile compartment, I had to know which tube was empty because that was the one we was doing the exercise on.
Yeah, very important.
Yeah, otherwise we'd be firing a real missile, so which wouldn't have been good.
And the day-to-day life on board, I mean, you mentioned sleeping there. Was that difficult to get rest?
It was, because obviously being on a semi-war footing all the time, that's the only way I can put it. He was on edge anyway. So he was pulling up to a couple of duties a day. So he was doing like so many watches a day. And then there was, if you turned in for a sleep, everybody had to turn to clean ship. So you had to get out of bed and clean whatever department you was going to do. And then you'd have an exercise. It could be anything. It might not be a missile firing. It could be another exercise. It could be a fire drill. It could be anything. You was out your pit again and, you know, doing the exercise. So you had to get used to the lack of sleep. And, you know, and obviously a lot of people used to use a quarter amount of alcohol to sort of make sure they got some sleep.
How readily was alcohol available?
Well, allegedly it was 2 cans per man, per day, but I've never seen that. It's more like up to a crate a day for some people. So, yeah, I think you could basically have as much as you want as long as you didn't cause any problems and you'd done your job.
I guess you were almost permanently on duty, but when you were, like, not on duty, what did you do to entertain
yourself? There was various
things.
There was quite odd. I'd actually had a lad who I used to knock around with, Paddy, who worked in the torpedo compartment. He was another WEM, the same as me, but he was a field gunner, so he was quite fit and he was a big lad. So me and him used to do a lot of weights, free weights, and pyramid press-ups and stuff like that. There was exercise bikes and rowing machines, which I made use of. And then the other one that most people enjoyed the best was either board games or watching movies. So we had, because we was on a Polaris, we had the choice of the most up-to-date movies that the military had. So we'd have a couple of movie showings a day. So basically, whatever shift you was on, you could get to watch a movie.
Did they ever show any submarine movies?
Not that I can remember. My first patrol, the most favourite movie, was Who Dares Wins with Lewis Collins. And that was like, everybody loved that and we kept having it on. So
no, I can imagine, yeah, it's a pretty gung-ho movie, that one.
It prompted some kidnapping of officers.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Teddy bears and toys and stuff out the wardroom with a makeshift SAS pillowcase, sort of balaclavas.
So there was fun on boat as well.
Yeah, definitely.
What sort of what other practical jokes did you get up to?
The other one was, there was a guy who worked, he was a petty officer who worked up in the control room, and he was bald and he had a beard and everybody used to call him Furry Egg. And he had a specific mug that he always used to drink his tea in that was always in the control room, so that got kidnapped and a ransom note attached, etc., and things like that. And the other one that most people got up to was when we used the compactor. There was a specific name, and I think it was, I'm almost sure it's Peter the Eater. It was the nickname for it. And you used to have to phone up the control room. But I used to call it Michael the Muncher, George the Gruncher, and all sorts of things, anything except for Peter the Eater, just for a laugh, but, you know.
And, sorry, what was the compactor used for?
It was for compacting all the gash, basically all the food waste used to get compacted into aluminium tubes that you used to have to make out and fired overboard to get rid of the rubbish, obviously the food waste.
Right, so somewhere in the mid-Atlantic, there's piles and piles of your waste still there.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Or just the containers, I'd imagine. The waste would have gone by now, but definitely containers.
How long were the missions that you were on?
Yeah, they're varied, but the average could be from 8 weeks to 12 weeks. I mean, more personal patrols. I think I've done an 8 and a 10, I think, or an 8 and a 12. I can't really remember now because it's been a long time ago. But there was always a 2 week workup period prior to that. And then we come back in and then store ship and then put the missiles on board and all the ordnance, etc. And then we'd go on patrol proper. But that was like to sort out any niggles and make sure the crew was basically tested by onboard examiners to make sure he was ready to do the patrol and that everybody was doing what they're supposed to be doing.
And being in the missile compartment, yeah, how aware of you were what was going on in other areas of the ship? So if they picked up a contact nearby, yeah, and were manoeuvring away from that, would you have been aware of that?
Wouldn't know nothing about it at all. The only thing he was aware of, you had a generalisation of the submarine in each department, because during your Part 3 training, you had to tick off and learn each department. And there was a thing called an EBS system, which is an air breathing system, where you had to plug a mask in. So if we had a fire, there was an EBS run that you had to plug in. So you had to know where all the masks was on board the submarine, where the EBS route was. And you got tested, and part of the test was, in your own department, you was given a blacked-out mask. And you had to work your way around the department, going from one EBS unit to the other. That was part of the training. So, yeah, it's different.
Yeah, very, very different. And presumably you did training on how to escape from the submarine, yeah, in the event of an accident. Can you talk me through that?
Yeah. At the time, it was at Gosport at HMS Dolphin. There was a place called the SEST, which is Submarine Escape Training Tank. Everybody else called it the tank, and obviously submariners every 4 years had to qualify for that, and it's stamped in your pay book. So if anybody ever said there was a submariner, it was quite easy to find out whether there was or not, because you just check the pay book. But that only qualifies you for escape training. You've got to have your dolphins before you're actually a submariner officially. So that was another thing he was issued with. But the escape training was, from memory, I'd done 2 free ascents from 30 foot, one from 60, and they was like in an airlock, and all you had on was swimming trunks, goggles, nose clip, which was attached to the goggles, and like an half-inflated life jacket, and basically it was pressurised to the depth, and your backside was pushed against the hatch, and you was basically told to take a deep breath and shoved out. And then you had to blow all the way out to the surface, because obviously your lungs are pressurised at that depth. And if you held your breath, you'd pop your lungs. But it was a bit scary when you got towards the surface, because you run out of breath. So there was a small pocket of air still in your lungs, which apparently is always in there, even when you die. There's still that pocket in there. And that reinflated your lungs because of the pressure. So you got a second wind and then broke surface.
That must have been...
That is incredibly
exciting.
Yeah, it was definitely exciting.
Yoni, of course. Yeah.
But then the most exciting one was the 100-foot one from the single-man escape tower at the bottom of the tank. For that, he was suited up in a big orange suit. It had an hood, and it had a breathing system, an umbilical that plugged in to the escape tower, and it pumped it up with oxygen. And obviously that was done to the same pressure as the tank pressurised. So he was already breathing that pressure in. And there was a small window, and I can remember one of the tank guys, they call them swim guys, that's from my memory. And you would have had a pre-signal thing where if it was all good, you put your thumb up. If it weren't, you put it sideways, and if not, you put it down. So I got to a point where the hatch was just about to go, and one of my ears wouldn't pop, and I was in absolutely agony, and I put it sideways, and he went. And then I put it down, and he went, taking light. So I knew what he was saying. The next minute, the hatch opened and all the water come in. I bobbed up and there's two divers there and they clagged me onto this line that went straight up the centre of the tank. And to my recollection, it took 25 seconds or thereabout to go 100 foot. It was one ride and off. And you actually come out of the water past your knees and then you end up on your back and obviously you float and somebody drags you to the side. And with every one of those escapes, you have to stand on a line for about 10 minutes to make sure you're no decompression problems, and there was a decompression tank there. But due to a quirk of fate, I ended up doing mine with some Italian special forces, and they couldn't speak English and I couldn't speak Italian, so they, because I was the only right in there and I was covered in tattoos already, they thought I was something special, but I was just a normal Jack. But that was quite funny because they was treating me the same as them, but I wasn't, you know, so I done mine with them because I done the free ascent. I think I done the free ascents with my class, but when it come to doing the 100 foot, I couldn't do that because I'd had a cold. So I got backclassed with the 100 foot one till I was healthy enough to do it. Hence why I probably had the hearing problem when I was in the 100 foot one. I still probably got a bit of a cold.
And you mentioned to me earlier something around a transmitter or...
A diaphragm detonator.
Yeah.
And when we used to load the missile tubes, well, the missiles, there's a diaphragm that fitted on the top. And the best way of explaining it is like a giant communion wafer. And it had a weakened part in it. I believe it was quartered, so it was like a cross, but it could have been one line. My mind's not really focused on that, but I do remember there was four detonators per tube. So these detonators was like a little diode, quite small, probably a couple of mil with some legs on. And then we was told that obviously any static would set them off, and if they went off, they'd blow your fingers off. So that was a bit of a worry, seeing as you've got like up to 15 operational tubes and you've got to put four on each tube. And it's freezing cold, and you've got a nylon waterproof jacket on, and probably nylon waterproof trousers, depending on what type of person you was. And then all you had was a little bracelet. It was classed as an anti-static bracelet with a small lead and a crocodile clip to clag onto something metal. So that was a bit of a worry, but it was still fun as well. So it was one of them. You know.
So you were actually in the missile tube to do.
He was on top of it. The hatch was opened up,
right.
And obviously. The diaphragm's already been fitted, and then we're climbing inside the missile tube on the top to put the diaphragm detonators in.
Right, and what was the role of these detonators?
Basically, when the missile was launched, just before the missile, the cone and the warhead, the missile, the top of the diaphragm, the detonators would blow up and it would come through without damaging the warhead.
Right, so
obviously also it kept the water out.
So it was like to release the cover
on
top of the warhead just before it got launched?
No, not the warhead itself. It's separate. It was actually part of the missile tube rather than the actual warhead.
Okay.
And the missile.
Okay.
If you can imagine, like you open a bottle lid and it's got that thin layer of foil on the top to stop the water coming out. It's that sort of thing. Nothing goes in and nothing comes out.
That's a great description. I can understand that one.
Yeah, well, I thought that's the best way to do it for people who've got, you know, you've got to try and visualise something you've never seen.
Yeah, no, that's fine. The other thing that you were mentioning to me before was around some sort of survival transmitter that would have gone up with the crew. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, from memory, it was given to every fifth or sixth man and basically got strapped to your legs and fried your nuts because it was radioactive. So you'd have your escape suit on and every fifth or sixth per person and get this thing strapped to like a beacon, basically. And got strapped to your leg and fried your nuts. Also, you had to wear a nice nappy before you put the suit on because obviously if you defecated or weed yourself and using cold water, you'd have that you'd be settling in the small of your back and you'd be paralysed, which... You know, it does sound the best, but obviously they've thought things through. In a big orange suit. And then apparently when you hit the surface, you all tie yourselves to each other and you're floating around with these beacons attached to you, throwing your nuts till you get rescued.
Oh, you're giving me some great descriptions here, Johnny. Absolutely brilliant descriptions. How did they monitor your exposure to radiation?
The only time you had it monitored was if you actually was going in and out of a reactor compartment, which most people never did. The only time I ever done that was not while I was serving on board the submarine, but when I was working for SESD, which was the Submarine Environmental Support Department. And what we used to deal with was contaminated items on board the subs or going into the reactor compartments and doing cleanups and relagging. And also if there was an incident on base, we was the ones who had to react to the incidents on base and decontaminate things and areas. So that was quite interesting as well, because I learned quite a bit about radiation, and obviously I was exposed to a bit more than I expected to be. But, you know, it's one of those things. I've fathered three kids, all right, they're no defects. And I've got two grandkids that I'm fine, so I presume the radiation had no effect.
Yeah. What would you say was your sort of hairiest situation that you got involved in?
Well, there's probably the two that I'd want to talk about. There's one that I don't want to talk about. Hairiest in safety-wise, it was we had an incident where he was on exercise, and somebody in the control room messed with the wrong valves, and instead of surfacing bow first, we come out arse end first, and the prop got chewed up, but we only missed the bottom of the lock, allegedly, by 25 foot. So we was quite close to getting killed, but at the time I was in the missile compartment hanging off a missile tube, like in a cartoon with my legs parallel to the deck, and things was rolling around, and I just found it really funny. But, you know, that's the way I am. I'm wired in them circumstances rather than scream or shout or laugh.
Well, I guess that's a good psychological position to be in on a submarine, because there's somebody panicking on a submarine.
Yeah, not good. I've seen that. I've seen somebody trying to open an hatch, and they got it with hammers and tools till they released what they was trying to do, and that was in my department as well. And then I was dragged off down to the medical to get injected and calm down.
And were there any crew who sort of decided this wasn't for them?
There was quite a few. I think with a lot of people had issues while they was on board. Some of them was quite bad alcoholics. Some people was quite angry and depressive. Other people was like just annoying. Because obviously, if you can imagine, not everybody on board the submarine is going to be a cup of tea, even in the junior rates, and you've got to live with these people for 10, 12 weeks. You might not have to work with them, but you've got to live with them. And a lot of things come out by the time you're at the end of your patrol. And the one thing that was like light relief, which you probably don't know about this, because this is probably, I've never told you about this.
We love an exclusive, Johnny.
This is definitely an exclusive. There was a magazine called The Sunday Slag, which used to get produced and Xeroxed in my department, so I did get to see a lot of it. Basically, what it was people would go around with notebooks and they'd listen to people's conversations and then they'd get written down. And the next thing you know, what you thought was a private conversation was now everybody's entertainment with embellishments. And it was in the Sunday Slag every Sunday. So we all used to look forward to reading that because we wanted to see who was going to get beasted and slagged off in that. But that was quite funny.
And did that include officers as well?
Everybody. Everybody was fair game. Everybody. In fact, you know, there was a lot of things about junior rates, but the senior rates and officers, there was no escape.
And how were the officers in terms of how they, you know, worked with you and treated you?
From memory, I mean, I never had any problem with any officers whatsoever. I think if I had any problems, that was with senior rates, not with the officers. The officers were very professional, always polite. And I can't even remember any officers actually using bad language, which, looking back, in them circumstances, that takes some sort of control and, you know, and you've got to be a different sort of person, you know, to be able to do that. Because most of the language was disgusting, you know, even by my standards. And I've heard some things, but some of them was really sad. But
hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
I think that's the right coping mechanism for some people, you know, especially working class people. But it is what it is. I've got no complaints about any of the officers. In fact, the skipper on board my submarine, he's a really nice guy, and he was quite easy to talk to. It was him who actually I approached before I left the submarine to get off the submarine, and then he got me the job at SESD, which is the submarine environmental support department. And I'd had a few incidents on board the submarine, which I'm going to get into, but I got blamed for a couple of things, which was nothing to do with me. But I was the one who everybody thought had done it, so that was not the best. When I was only young myself, I was only like 21, but then, no, not really. I would say immature as well, because obviously 21's nothing, is it? You know, it's an immature age. I've got kids older than that now, and I still think they're kids. So says it all, really.
Were you able to communicate with home while you were on?
No, but there was a one-way communication where you used to get these things called family grams, and they'd fill them in, and you'd get like a little thin ticker-type message that, to memory, was, I think it was 38 words, and two of those was your name and your rank. So, obviously, depending on how they'd worded the message, sometimes it never made sense, or it was like a really short message, and it was a waste of a family gram. Because you used to look forward to it, because obviously it was your only contact with the outside world. And some people never understood how important it was. You know, there's people who actually lost the plot because they'd had either bad news or the message was wrong, or they was waiting for a family gram and they hadn't had one for weeks and everybody else is getting them. You know, it can have a quite a bad, you know, effect on people's psyche, really.
Yeah, because I heard that the officers checked them before they went.
Yeah, there was. Yeah, yeah
out in yeah. case it was bad news.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's true. I can remember one guy was, and this is 100% true. He was a petty officer or a chief petty officer, and he wasn't told, but his daughter had been sexually assaulted. They'd known before we finished the patrol, and even when we was on the surface coming back, they knew. And they never transferred him off. And he never got off till we got into port. So they could have got him off earlier. You know, and he didn't have a good effect on him. He really lost the plot.
Yeah, no, it's hard to imagine news like that.
Yeah.
As you got towards the end of a patrol, were you looking forward to the end of it?
Or yeah.
How did you... How did you feel? Well, I've heard that some, you know, some members of the crew, they just got so used to that life that they trying to adjust when they came home was quite difficult.
Yeah, I think for me it was probably the opposite because I'd only done a few workups and two actual patrols. I hadn't really had the experience of like being institutionalised to that type of stuff. You know, so I was still looking forward to going home, and I quite regularly, whether I was on crew or off crew. If I could go home, even for a weekend, I'd travel from Scotland to the Midlands, which I'd have to 6.5 hours by train, you know, and then catch a train from Birmingham or a taxi from Birmingham back up to the Black Country. So it was a bit of a jaunt just to come home for a weekend, because obviously you've got to do that on the way back as well. So I always used to catch the train back from Birmingham. It was 20 past midnight I used to catch a train. So I used to get in for about 7 into Ellensborough, just in time to clock back on for me job or whatever at 8 o'clock when I was off crew. So you get back to your mess, change, and you'd be back at work again like nothing had happened.
And when the hatches open for the first time after a, you know, multi-month trip, what was that moment like?
For me, I found the smell was quite potent and used to make me feel sick because it smelt of obviously salt from the seawater, but there was a fishy smell to it as well. And after breathing in, I suppose, recycled air and quite pure, I suppose, to a degree, apart from the male smells that you'd expect in a confined space, it was very pungent, and you know, it took some getting used to. I used to feel sick for at least an hour when we first opened the hatches, and then obviously then you got used to it and you're back to breathing proper air. You know,
I guess it's almost too much for the senses after you've been, as you say, breathing recycled air.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, I think if it had been done gradually, maybe not the case, but obviously they have to degas the batteries and all that sort of stuff. So it's more to do with safety as well. So they've got to get the hatches open, degas the batteries. And then after that's done, people are usually allowed to smoke then. But that's one point where you're not allowed to smoke, you know, is all them degassing the batteries. Right. For obvious reasons, you know. not safe.
And if you look back at your time on Polaris, is there anything you miss about that?
The camaraderie and some of the guys. I knew I had some good friends. And I did like the fact that I was doing an important job, even though I didn't particularly enjoy being on a submarine, if that makes sense. It probably didn't make no sense. But the fact that I was doing, I felt I was doing my duty properly. And the fact that we was like a small elitist type of unit, I suppose, really, because of the amount of people that actually serve on at sea at that time, any given time. You felt a little bit special. But you also, in the bigger picture, you realised if you ever done your job, then that wouldn't be a good thing either. But people would have still done it because that's what you're there for.
Well, how did you feel about that responsibility? Because essentially you were going to launch something that was going to kill millions of civilians.
Yeah, I would. At the time, I would have done it because it was my duty, but not until I left did it really sort of sink in. And I did initially have a few nightmares about it, about nuclear holocausts and stuff. But it's a two-edged sword because, one, by having a nuclear deterrent, you're stopping other people from nuking you. But in the other hand, it's a thing that's been invented that's phenomenally horrendous, really. You couldn't think of anything worse, you know, to do to people. So it's a double-edged sword for me, because obviously I thought, for me personally, I think the Cold War kept peace, world peace, not peace in countries, but world peace, because obviously the bigger powers knew if they'd done a nuclear strike, there'd be a retaliatory strike. So there's no actual winners. And obviously there would have been a massive devastation, probably worldwide, because if everybody decided to launch, then, you know, nobody knows where the targets was, so nobody knows where they're coming from or who's going to get them. So it would have been a really bad thing. But on the upside of that, it stopped a lot of world wars, in my opinion, that could have... You know, we've had small wars, but not like we had in World War II. I think the atom bomb being dropped on the Japanese in World War II was like a signal to the world, this is what could happen. And I think most people took notice, even the Russians.
Yeah. Yeah, and that Japanese bomb was tiny compared to the firepower of your submarine.
Yeah,
had.
Well, apparently, from memory, one of the missiles was equivalent to all the bombs dropped in World War II, ordnance-wise, and both the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So that's just one missile. And obviously, we had multiples, you know, up to 15 missiles at a time. And then, obviously, the American submarines was even bigger, and some of the Russian ones was even bigger than that. Plus, then you got your planes delivering nuclear packages as well. So, it was worrying, but also the upside of that as well is it was also nobody in the right mind is going to launch a nuclear missile. So, you know.
Did you have to be particularly quiet on the boat?
Not usually. There was times where we had we run quiet, and the one from memory was we actually got followed by a Russian submarine, but I've no idea of the distance away it was, but we was told about it, and we did have to run quiet. There was no movies, no use of exercise stuff, no music, all the rest of it, and obviously the sonars and radars that they used and all the other equipment was on passive, which I think they are anyway, but there would be no active stuff going on. And I believe that this Russian submarine had got a nitrogen sniffing device on it, on the nose cone of it. And because it got that in the bows, it could follow the plume of nitrogen that was coming out the back of our submarine when we was making our own water. So from the desalination plant, that was the nitrogen was being discharged out of seawater. And that was picked up by the Russians, which is pretty clever, really.
That is really smart. Not something I'd heard before. That's really interesting. Is there anything about your career on Polaris that we've not covered, or any anecdote or story that you think is worth?
The only anecdote for me to add is that obviously I knew the submarine was big because the department I was on was quite big, and that was only a third of the submarine. But we actually, after that incident with the prop, we had to go into dry dock, and when you actually see one in dry dock, you realise the vastness and the size of it. And it's absolutely awesome to see in a dry dock. And then you think, well, some of the Russian ones would be like three times as big. And even the American ones is bigger than ours. So you think there's some big beasts in the sea.
Really there is. Big. I mean, have you seen the photo? I think it's the Typhoon class, yes. The Soviet one. And that is huge. And it had like a plunge pool in there for the for the crew as well.
Yeah. I can imagine. Yeah, there would be, you know, obviously the bigger the submarine, the more things that can fit into it. And obviously, if the crew's going to be at sea for a long, long period of time, you've got to have something for them to... Because American crews run dry, so they have no alcohol. But I think they've got a drug problem, from what I can remember. I'd imagine the Russians would drink. I would imagine it'd be mainly vodka. And obviously that's part of Russian culture, plunge pools and all that stuff. So, yeah, I think it's like a cultural thing, which is probably good.
What were the washing facilities like on Polaris? Could you shower whenever you wanted?
I was allowed to shower whenever I wanted. Obviously, you might have to wait sometimes if somebody was in there. From recollection, there was three showers. Obviously, there was open showers. And there was three or four traps, which was... There's a story about them. Quite often, they'd the pressure build back up and you'd have like a backfiring up the toilets. If you want in the toilet, you could hear the people inside panicking, trying to open the doors because there was concertina doors and stainless steel loos. And I've seen a few people come out covered in facial matter and paper and stuff when they've gone over them. But that's quite funny if you're in the shower, but not so funny if you're in the toilet. But yeah, that's probably the only... never had a problem keeping clean. The only thing that they never really recommended is we cut hair or, you know... Some people shaved, most people never bothered. You know, there was no sort of strict rule whether you'd done one or the other, but haircuts was a no-no, unless they specifically run out an order for one day where they might do the haircuts and then I'd have to change a load of filters, because obviously it would be like, from what I can remember, there was like carbon filters. So they'd have to change all them because of all the air particles in the atmosphere. But most people just grew their hair in the beards.
So you'd come back looking like a real U-boat crew then, wouldn't you?
But not smelling like one.
No. Yeah. No.
Diesel submariners, believe me, they smell totally different to what we was called by them was bomber queens, because we had a good lifestyle.
I've interviewed a few diesel submariners, there's a friendly rivalry there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's a friendly rivalry between each submarine and type of submarine, the crews as well, the port and starboard crews on Polaris, and even more rivalry between the Navy and the Royal Marines, because they was based on our base and they wasn't allowed off base, so they thought it was their base.
What would you say was your proudest moment?
Getting me dolphins, when I actually passed my Part 3 training and I was actually presented with the other Part 3 trainees with the dolphins, and you had your dolphins pinned on your uniform, and we didn't have it on the uniform because we had number 8s on, but there was like a bit of a tradition where people had put the dolphins and come along and fist, so you ended up with two marks on your chest where the dolphin pins had stuck in your chest. But you know, it was just one of them things, I think.
Yeah, another practical joke.
Never ending.
There's further information such as photos and videos in our episode notes, which we'll show as a link in your podcast app. Now, this show wouldn't exist without our generous Patreons, so I want to thank one and all of them for their support. You can very easily become a Patreon by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And you can also join our Facebook group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Thanks very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.